The primary.
Saturday night in Los Angeles, 10 o'clock, and that means, of course, it's open mind. And I am Bill Jenkins. Welcome aboard. For the next 2 hours, we're going to take you on another one of those little journeys. A journey that may sort of stretch your imagination, or we call it your reality box, as it were. You know, we all have one, a reality box. It's the name we put on it, and it seems to have caught on, and it works a little bit. If it is something, your reality box is shaped by your education, your living experiences, your thinking experiences, your religion, all of those things in life. And within that, then, is your reality box. And that's where all the information you have resides. And that's the window through which you view reality. Now, if you hear something that is outside of that reality box, you usually say that it's not true, or that the person is hallucinating, or they're crazy, or they're trying to deceive you, or all kinds of things. And even if it happens to be the perception of your own senses, then you assume that you are hallucinating, or perhaps you're going over the deep end. But what we have found out here in the last better than 4 years on this program, that isn't true. That isn't necessarily true. And that the reality box through which most of us view reality is nothing more than a peephole rather than a window that it should be. So tonight we want to stretch your reality box a little bit, and to help us is, for an encore appearance tonight, Dr. Lawrence Boren. Larry, welcome aboard to Open Mind tonight.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here again, Bill.
Now, Larry has a few things that will work on your reality box a little bit, like the world is really upside down, turvy, and crazy, right? We're just doing it all wrong. Now, Larry, we have a highly technological society going on.
Mm-hmm.
Rather pristine. It seems to be working rather well. We're able to do a lot of things. Certainly have a lot of things on the boards and a lot of things coming down the pike and down the line. Mm-hmm. How in the world can we create this great technology that we're looking at if we have it backwards?
It's a very strange situation. I must admit it's strange. When I first found it in my science research, dealing with magnetism and gravity and so on, I couldn't understand. I mean, they would say, okay, it works by the same mathematical equations, whether you view it this way or that way. The mathematics seems to be right. Why is it upside down? Well, let's just take for a moment gravity, okay? Now, I happen to be a believer that it's not just important whether things work, but what is most important to the life of mankind is whether we understand what's happening in this world. I mean, we're here to gain understanding, hopefully, and wisdom and that sort of thing. You know, that's the only thing we're going to take with us, basically, is wisdom and understanding and a few other inner qualities and attainments. We're not going to take the technology with us or the materialism of any kind or any degree. So what's very important is to see if we can understand the laws and the principles that govern the universe we live in. Now, does that sound unreasonable?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, if I'm able to prove, for example, that gravity is a downward push instead of a downward pull, even though it obeys the same mathematical equation, I still consider that an advancement in understanding and wisdom and understanding what's actually happening.
Now, I have a question for you, just offhand.
Of course.
A gentleman just published a number of papers, particularly in the Register.
Right, I saw that.
About gravity.
Uh-huh.
I had a chance to talk to him for a few minutes. I didn't have a chance to get to him to any great detail. And he even bought time on this radio station concerning that. Did you read his papers on gravity, and do you agree with him or disagree with him?
I had quite a struggle trying to get a hold of that paper, but I finally did. And I read it very carefully two or three times. Okay. I would say he has an interesting approach. He uses the atomic level approach of that atoms, the atomic structure itself, atomic forces create the gravitational
mm-hmm.
reaction. But the interesting thing, I could agree with him on his basic concept, but it's just that in that article, which was a whole page in a newspaper, he did not reveal really that the technique behind what he was driving at. He just hinted at it. He said, in effect, that gravity is the interaction between the atomic structure of every atom and the ambient energy that fills all space. Aha! That is significant.
Now, we've talked about that ambient energy quite often. It has a number of names that range from radiant energy to diatom energy to whatever. Is that the same kind of energy, do you think, that he's talking about? This all-pervasive sea of energy that we live in?
That some have called the ether, according to the new definition of the ether.
I think that's what Einstein referred to it as.
He referred to it, of course, as the time-space continuum, but actually Einstein imbued it with a certain materiality, if I may say so. Now, may I pursue that for one couple of seconds? Einstein actually said that if space can be deformed by the presence of large celestial bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Can be deformed. Now, when you attribute anything, give it the capacity to be deformed or warped, he sometimes called it, and into a curved nature, to a curved degree, from a flat or straight degree to a curved degree, you're attributing a material reality to that time-space continuum, see? And therefore, I say, you must apply Newton's third law of motion, which is that for every action in one direction, there has to be an action equal and opposite, equal in force, but opposite in direction. That, for some strange reason, Einstein didn't quite get to that point. So he didn't recognize any forces operating in his gravity theory.
Do you agree with Newton on that?
No. See, actually, the conclusions I arrived at was sort of a blending of Einstein and Newton's thinking sort of together.
Newton was very definite about it. Einstein was vague about it. And you've kind of come up in the middle between the two, is that it?
Well, I found a way to reconcile, in a sense, or integrate their two points of view to some degree. That's a portion of Newton's thinking and teaching, which is called the third law of motion. See, that says that any force moving in one direction will experience a reactive force moving in the other direction. So that if objects called celestial objects, stars and planets, deform space in an outward direction, see, which on our planet Earth here is upwards from the surface, then it will experience a reactive force that will be from space itself, mind you, pushing downwards. Now, for those who believe in the ether theory of some sort, whether it's the neutrino ether or the electron positron ether or some other kind of an ether, it's filled with ambient energy, as this gentleman called it, and that ambient energy then reacts and becomes the vehicle for this reacting force that's going to press downwards, mind you, to meet the force that's pressing upwards against it.
Well, the main reason I mention that, Larry, is that I've received a lot of calls since that article appeared.
Uh-huh. I should have.
And I wish I could remember the gentleman's name. I met him.
Waltman, wasn't it? Or something like that.
Yes, something like that.
Waltman.
And there may be some calls to you because you do want to talk about gravity. You think we have the world upside down in terms of the way we are...
Understanding.
Understanding or assessing gravity.
Right. Even though the mathematics remains the same, but still, I think it's very important.
Would it be safe to say that most people feel or have been taught that gravity is the result of the pull of this planet... on all things that were within the sphere of its size and dimension and its weight or its atomic weight.
And its mass, as they call it.
Or mass.
Right. That's what we've been taught. And, you know, when Einstein read Newton's theory on this, he reacted violently eventually or gradually as he thought about it more and more against Newton's concept there.
We found out a curious thing, for instance, on our flights to the moon. We figured we knew what the mass of the moon was, and we figured we knew what the mass of the Earth was, and therefore we knew where the masses of the two planets would equalize each other.
Yeah.
There was a certain point in space.
Yeah.
And we found out that the moon had much greater mass than we thought because that point was much closer to the Earth than we thought it would be.
I heard something about that. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Excuse me, further away from the Earth than we thought it would be.
Possibly further, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's very fascinating. Did you have a further question to pursue on the...
No, I want you to go ahead with why we've got the idea of gravity upside down.
Okay. Well, the question is a very moot question. I've tried to argue it with some physicists and scientists. And, of course, the basic thing I find always with scientists is they are the... You know, they are the high priests of this new wisdom called science in the last 200 or 300 years. And if you haven't taken their exact courses of training and brainwashed your brain in a certain way to see things their way and put on their kind of glasses to look at reality, you just don't know nothing, you see, about reality.
Well, Larry, is that unfair? People that are trained in science should be able to talk about science and speak with it with some authority. I would feel more comfortable with a person doing that than had they been trained in banking and start telling me about physics or medicine or whatever.
Yeah, you'd think so. But the strange thing is that a true understanding of nature is not derived from the left brain alone, and that is the brain that the scientist uses 98% of the time, with few exceptions. Einstein, I would say, probably used 50-50 from his left and right brain, and perhaps Newton did too. and a few of the others. But 99% of them use only their left brain. You cannot attain understanding by using your left brain alone. That's the basic. It's simple as that. Einstein knew it, and I think Newton and a few others have found it.
Tesla certainly knew.
Tesla certainly knew. In other words, they received their greatest enlightenment and insights into the workings of nature through the right brain, talking to their left brain. And then they use the left brain to supply all the specifics and the details of the data that tends, finally, to support what their right brain revealed.
Now, before we take a break, where have we got it upside down about gravity? The idea that the Earth is pulling?
It's interesting because Newton, as anyone who investigates very closely, really had no evidence whatsoever to support this notion. It was purely a speculation, which Einstein finally caught him on, so to speak. But this was purely speculation that there is this attracted pull in all matter, such as from the center of the Earth, that is pulling everything downwards towards the center of the Earth. But why should we worship this notion when there's absolutely not a shred of evidence to support that particular claim? The evidence for the law, the force law that he used, the gravity force law, that it varies as the square of the distance, or with the inverse square of the distance, it tends to work out exactly that way. But strangely enough, before Newton, there was Kepler and William Gilbert of England, who both developed a solar force law acting on the planets, only it was a magnetic force. And it worked by the same law, the same inverse square law. So what do you think of that? And there you have an entirely different force acting, but using the same mathematics.
Well, I'm curious about one thing, Larry. Now, NASA, for instance, whenever they send flights to the moon and send flights to the planets and beyond, and to all of them, and they do it very, very successfully, they use a science that very roughly is known as orbital mechanics in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we just whipped a satellite around the moon so we could go off and do something else we wanted to do, using the laws of orbital mechanics. And those laws are basically built upon Newton's theory. And yet they seem to work.
Yeah, but you see, Einstein had the same mathematics, but in basically a different approach entirely. He also rejected this downward pull idea. And what my point is that Einstein developed this new notion of curved space, that every celestial object is curving the space around it. But no scientist that I could talk to could ever quite explain to me what Einstein's ultimate picture of the gravity force was. In fact, every single textbook says that Einstein did not deal with a force at all. And so that's where I take exception with Einstein. See, I'm saying that Einstein should have used a little bit of Newton's ideas, and that one, called the third law of motion, is very important and significant, because Einstein was using a force from the Earth and every celestial body pressing on his space-time continuum. See, exerting a force on it. You can't deny that. I mean, no scientist can deny that. If Einstein was here right this moment, I don't think he could worm out of that one.
Well, what would you say gravity is right now, then?
Well, you see, it's the reactive force coming from the space-time continuum, if you want to use Einstein's term, or from the etheric substance that fills all space, which is made of ambient energy, in the terminology of Mr. Waltman there. So, you see, it's like a material, a substance. This ether is like a substance. And when it's distorted by physical substance, it reacts with a physical force. See, even though it is non-physical itself, in essence, it is non-physical. It's called we're calling it etheric substance or space-time continuum. But it obeys this material law, nevertheless. When it's pushed on in one direction, it pushes back. And that's the pushing back is the gravity force.
In other words, I'm able to sit in this chair because something's pushing down on me rather than something is pulling down on me.
That's it, exactly. Now, isn't that opposite? Isn't that one is opposite to me?
That's rather the other way that I would have been taught, of course, to believe that.
It's a pressure pushing down on us.
Until I started doing this show, Larry, and I've learned to not believe anything. And to believe everything.
And to believe everything.
And at the same time, it's sort of upside down this way. Sort of an upside down person. Do you have another upside down, topsy-turvy thing that you'd like to get into? I want you to get into it after we take just a very short break.
Oh, yes.
And then we'll go to the callers, because I think they want to talk to you about a number of things that you've said before.
They might.
And
they might.
You may have to say tonight.
Turn had created and evolved itself out of nothing. That's point one that's upside down. I mean, to those who have an intuitive approach to these things. Point two, it did so without any plan, purpose, or design, just mechanically and purely through chance and random accident. That's what they teach us, and that's what they teach in all the schools and colleges. Point three, therefore, there's nothing sacred about the universe or any part of it. No awe-inspiring higher power of any kind to be concerned about or to relate to. Point four, therefore, such ideas as God, spirit, soul, cosmic mind, creator, or the evolution of consciousness, those such concepts are totally invalid. The world of matter alone is real.
Now, Larry, do you really feel that there are a lot of people who do not believe that there is a creative force that is far greater than the human mind out there at work?
Well, in my study
I have to disagree with you. I think that most people will accept the fact that this is not all happenstance.
Yeah, but my point is this. This is what the education system is set up to teach to the pupils and students that go through it. And it's under the influence of the scientists that they do so. I mean, I'm not saying that all the students end up buying this. At some point in their life, maybe in their 20s or 30s, they throw out a lot of what they've learned in the school system and say, well, it really isn't that way at all. But nevertheless, there is a subtle brainwashing going on, and I say it's a conspiracy, my friend. I really do believe that. There are a lot of conspiracies out there. And
well, we can look at our school system, and we know that something has been happening, that we have now probably produced the worst school system on the planet.
Yes, exactly.
And if somebody wants to challenge me on that, I would welcome it, but this is not the forum for it.
Right, right.
But it's hard for me to believe, really, that too many people are accepting that all of this is just science. Naturally, you know, I deal with a lot of very, very scientific people.
Mm-hmm.
And
but those
I don't know of one
science.
Yet who doesn't agree that there is something incredible out there that has fashioned all of this or set up the rules and regulations or the laws upon which all of this came about.
But I think you're dealing mainly with what we call New Age scientists, or those who join, you know, participate in this new trend of thinking. You're not dealing with the orthodox mind of science, because I've dealt with a lot of them. I've read thousands of pages of their material, and they totally believe in the worship of materialism. I want to call a spade, if I may, and that's what I'm calling it. That's what they teach in all the textbooks and all the courses, 99% of the time. There may be occasionally an exception in a teacher or professor who is willing to suggest the idea that maybe there is some kind of a higher power out there, but he's generally censored if he says very much in that direction. That's the way I understand it, Bill, and I've followed this for many years. And I will call a spade. That's the way I see it. That's the way I've found it to be. Now, I find it
very difficult for me to argue with you, because when I was in the school system was some years ago.
Yeah.
And certainly in the science classes that I was in, that was always understood, that there was a greater power out there.
Really?
But we were dealing with, as far as the science that we were dealing with, the things that we were able to observe, see, and understand.
Mm-hmm.
And this was simply from human observation. We were never able to understand, for instance, why that a female could have a baby. We just accepted the fact that that was God's business, and there it was, and it did its thing. Now we understand a great deal more about it than we did in the 50s whenever I was studying these things. But are you telling me now that as time has gone on, we have excluded the higher power, and of course all of this is the working of the movement of molecules.
That's precisely what they try to say, even in behavioristic psychology, which still rules the roost in psychology. You know, they teach that thoughts and feelings and ideas and so on are nothing but chemical reactions in the brain from molecular combinations that strangely create these strange fantasies or inner workings of the mind, but they do not attribute any reality.
Just molecules and electrons going up there and having a heyday, and we end up being a recipient of all of these little emotions that we feel and feelings that we feel and all that.
All the evolution of pure accident and random happenings. It all goes back to the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty, that everything is kind of random in the universe, basically.
Do you really feel that a lot of people buy that?
I feel that 95% of the brainwashed scientists certainly absolutely do buy that.
You're talking about the scientific community, then.
Yeah, the scientific community, by and large, except the exception, which is the New Age scientist that has... He introduces the faculty called intuition into his thinking, see, from the right brain. And then he comes up with a whole new perspective. But, Bill, that is not found in the usual scientist who writes the textbooks and gives the lectures and so on. So I am protesting against the science establishment to that extent that they undermine. In fact, they laugh at the concept of a right brain or intuitive mind or higher mind or anything like this.
But I find the government now talking about right brain and left brain and some of their things that they're putting out. And, you know, whenever the government starts talking about it, that we've had to do about 50 years of a cell job somewhere down the line.
Well, I'd like you to show me some of those papers. They can't even accept the reality of UFOs, for example, after 10 million sightings or some such
number. Well, they spend billions of dollars on it, but publicly they're not saying anything about it yet. That's next week's show, by the way. Bill Moore will be here.
Oh.
And we'll go into that. We understand that when the government talks about UFOs, that you're listening to Hot Air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way it's going to be for a while. But hopefully that will change.
Oh, yes. In time, it's got to change. So there's another thing I could go into for a moment about my discovery in the realm of color theory. Would that be of any interest on the Upside Down?
You do that because our lines are filling up. They want to talk to you, but go ahead and do the color theory thing.
Just real quick, I believe you recall, I've now placed them into a little slide mounts. I'm going to keep this a little bit in the realm of mystery. I'm just going to say that I've been able to demonstrate to anyone's visual perceptions. It's not a theory or something you can debate and argue about.
We're trying to do television on radio tonight, but we'll do it.
Right. So if I place these up to your eye anyway, let's just say I have something that is yellow in color and something that is blue in color. And I can either make green out of this combination, or I can make, lo and behold, by magic, I can make red out of yellow and blue, as well as green. Now, if that is true, and if you wish to look again, you have seen it yourself, and I've shown it to quite a few dozens of people. You know, your senses tell you, well, that's certainly absolutely a fact. I'm looking at pure green at this moment, and then a few seconds later, I'm looking at pure red from yellow and blue, nothing less. And this, most people will agree, definitely turns topsy-turvy the Newtonian theory of color.
Could I have those two slides? Because I have as a guest with me, who came in tonight, a gentleman who's in television. He works with NBC. And but that's all right. He knows color television. He knows color. And you put yellow and blue together, what color do you get?
Green.
You get green? Put those yellow and blues together.
You've got to also next go to those. Add those in.
Oh, I have to add these in?
Yeah.
Tell him what to do over there, then.
Mm-hmm.
I have Mr. Clint Houston with me tonight from NBC in Houston.
I see.
Mr. Houston from Houston.
Oh, great. Now, you've got to look up at a bright light, a bright white light. And remember, these are not pure white, but they're close to it. It works much better with the sunlight, which is 99% pure white light. And you'll find even...
That is indeed green.
Right.
Absolutely.
We're not getting the right color out of that.
No, wait a minute. Put the four together. Did you get the four?
That's two.
That's two, yeah.
That's green.
Okay.
And we'll
put two. Okay, the other two are green also.
Now we have red.
Should you?
I never knew that.
You've been dealing with color television cameras for years and years, right, Clint?
Yes.
That shouldn't work, should it?
No.
Yellow and blue should never make red, according to all the books I've ever read. And
that's just an amazing red that you get out of that, isn't it?
It's a pure red. It's quite a pure red. It's not an off red or some hallucination that some might call it.
Possibly you will show this on television.
Maybe you'll want to do that yourself, in fact.
It's rather...
That is quite a phenomenon.
I think so.
But it's part of the upside-down, topsy-turvy world we live in. That's not supposed to happen. Primary colors produce, whenever they're combined, primary colors. But I think Dr. Boren is showing us that that doesn't happen.
In fact, I'm showing you right here, by the way, just final summing it up. Two primaries can make a third primary. That's another way of putting it, which isn't ever supposed to happen.
Okay.
See, yellow and blue are primaries, and red is a primary.
Mm-hmm.
So two primaries should never make a third primary. And what it's suggesting, my friend, is simply quite awe-inspiring, and that is that maybe, just maybe, if we had the right facilities, we could prove that two colors, yellow and blue, could create the entire spectrum of color on television with two layers of color only instead of three, and two color cameras, and two layers in color printing and color photography would perhaps only be necessary to deliver the full gamut of color.
Well, don't some of the systems do that now using a magenta color and another one of those off colors, electron gun projectors?
No, I have never heard
projectors.
Of one that's using two.
One of the Japanese sets uses that. I forgot what it is.
I don't.
The one at home, I've got three big things.
I think they all use three, Bill. The only one that's dared to even suggest that there might be a way of using two is Edwin Land of the Land Polaroid Corporation, and he has an entirely different approach to this, and it isn't yellow and blue.
All right, you ready to go to the callers now?
Oh, I suppose so. Maybe they'll have some interesting reactions.
Well, I find out that the callers are far more better interrogators than I am.
Oh.
You know, I just kind of sit here and play traffic cop.
Well, you do a little bit more than that.
All right. Hal is on the line. Hal, welcome aboard.
Good evening. Before I get to my question, I was a little unclear about your discussion of the Heisenberg principle. You know, you mentioned that had to do with the universe being random. And my understanding was that it had to do with uncertainty, not being able to prove something under an experiment, because by experimenting it on something, you change it automatically. Is that what the Heisenberg principle is about?
That's what it has come to mean in the later interpretations. That's not quite what Heisenberg had in mind in 1926, approximately, when he came up with it. Purely that you can't measure, he said, momentum and the position of an atomic or subatomic particle at the same time. Well, that may, or yeah, I can understand why he said it. It would be a very difficult thing to measure. But my point is, I'll go along with Einstein, who came out later, a few years later, with two other physicists. They wrote an article in which they brought up the concept that there could well be hidden variables that are controlling the behavior of the electrons, rather than just a randomness that can never be called deterministic, that isn't based on cause and effect.
But we haven't located what the factors are affecting the subatomic particles, though.
Uh-huh. That's what they say, and they are right, they haven't. But I'm audacious enough to say that I have located it.
Dr. Boren has an idea that just may astound you.
Mm. Yeah, well...
Are you ready for it, Hal?
Oh, absolutely. I'm ready.
Well, maybe... I don't know if the whole physics community is, but we first came here a year and a month ago, almost... And we brought forth the notion that we've located the fundamental magnetic particle, or the fundamental, yes, that's what I should call it, the fundamental magnetic particle that creates both magnetism and what I call the magnetic electric approach to all phenomena in the universe, and it's called the positron.
You know what the positron is, Hal?
I've heard of it. It can only exist in conjunction with something else. Is that what it is? I'm not sure. I'm really not that. I've heard of it, though.
Well, let us take time out to give him a thumbnail sketch of a positron.
Real quick, you're basically right that it is considered not to exist outside of nuclear phenomena. It is actually, now I will now present my concept of the proton, you see. I'm saying that the proton derives its plus one charge from the presence of a positron within it, even though I guess almost every physicist in the world will disagree with me and say that the positron doesn't exist in the proton until it's suddenly... collides with another proton or a neutron, and then one positron suddenly leaves, and they'll say, well, that positron was manufactured at the moment of ejection, or in other words, just suddenly appeared out of nothing. Okay, well, I don't buy that. I say that the positron is what gives the proton its plus one charge, and it's giving a plus one magnetic charge and not an electric charge. And this plus one charge of the proton that's derived from the positron is what sets up a magnetic field at the center of every hydrogen atom and in every
other atom.
Every other atom in the universe, that is all the elements which are based on the presence of protons, like two protons in helium plus two neutrons and so on up the scale. And in every case, one of those protons is controlling one electron that, because it sets up at right angles to the magnetic field of the proton derived from the positron, it sets up an electric field according to the Faraday magnetic law of magnetic electric induction. So there's an induced electric field, and that's the field that the electron pursues in its pathway around the atom, and also accounts for its precessional motion, as called a precessing orbit. So I'm sorry, I don't agree with Heisenberg that the electron doesn't know what it's quite doing in the in going around the nucleus, going around the in the atom. That's the picture that we have still in quantum theory, you know, that the electron doesn't know what the hell it's doing. It's just going sort of staggering around randomly and can never be pinpointed as to where it's going or any pathway that it's going.
But it's doing a lot of work in our society.
It's doing a heck of a lot of work for staggering around as though it were intoxicated.
Well, for those folks that watch radio with pictures, they wouldn't have it without the electron. And indeed, they wouldn't even have cables without the electronics.
You wouldn't have anything in the electrical or electronic age of technology without the control of controlled motion of the electron, which is definitely never.
But the positron, you say, is basically a magnetic force instead of an electromagnetic force.
Yeah, I must clear that up, Bill. You're not saying it quite exactly 100% correctly. It's a magnetic electric particle, whereas the electron is an electromagnetic particle. One has a preponderance of magnetic energy, the positron. The other has a preponderance of electrical energy.
Now, Tony Sarantinis over in Phoenix will tell us that the positron has simply a coating on it that is magnetic rather than electromagnetic, but the core of it is electromagnetic.
Ah, okay. So we will have to we will part company a little bit there. I will say that the core...
But its properties become basically magnetic in so doing, which changes the way that electrons flow from a plus to minus pole.
See, I arrive at this purely from analyzing the rest energy of the positron versus the rest energy of the electron. And the rest energy of the positron is definitely magnetic, and the rest energy of the electron is 100% definitely electrical. And each one, when they go into motion, they develop the opposite field.
Okay. Does that help you, Howell? Because I don't want us to get into deep physics here.
No,
because,
this is very super.
Well, I want you to
know that I'm a journalist and I don't understand a great deal of all of this.
Well, I think it cleared up what the Heisenberg was originally trying to point out, and also it's interesting that you say that the path of an electron or the motion of an electron is predicated on the presence of the positron. I hope I absorbed it. But actually, I had a question that it was directed towards the original conversation of the program here, which was that Doctor. It says that what we should be seeking is understanding, not just the fact that the technology works and that the electricity flows through the copper and we turn on our TV and the picture comes on, but we should be looking for deeper questions and answers as to how and why things work in the first place.
Very good.
And my question is, how would this affect life on Earth? I mean, would it affect the quality of our life? Would it affect our consciousness or the material things around us? What would you say we have?
What is it? What are you referring to? It.
Well, the pursuit of the understanding. For instance, you say that the understanding that gravity is a push, the counter motion of the space being warped, the counter force. I'm sorry, of
counter
the warped. Yeah, the counter force of the warped space. Well, you say that it won't affect the mathematics of gravity computations, the inverse square root, and things like that. And so therefore it wouldn't actually radically change all the mathematics. So how would it change our lives?
What value is all this information is what you're asking.
Yeah, and the understanding.
All right.
I think that will come out in time. It's not something we can easily formulate at this time. For one thing, it enlarges our understanding of the significance of this etheric substance that fills all space, which is also called ambient energy.
Mm-hmm.
It has much greater power than we have dared to believe it had before.
Would this be the source of the quote-unquote infinite energy source that Tesla technology is heading towards?
I think in a way we're talking about those same things.
I think it borders on that.
Wilhelm Reich called it orgon energy. T. Henry Morey called it radiant energy. There have been a number of names for this energy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's something of an enormous study on the part of the scientific community now working for the government.
Right.
But to answer your question, I think, Hal, we're looking at a technology on this planet Earth which is, in at best, extremely primitive.
Right? Yeah. That would really hurt the egos of the scientists.
Well, nevertheless, it is.
Yes.
It's extremely primitive.
Right.
And I'm not trying to say anything other than where it's going to be. And as the technology becomes more and more precise, and you start building a technology on something that has worked in the past but may be not exactly right but worked before, it becomes more and more important that we understand the real workings of what makes the universe work.
Yes.
If we're going to build our technology upon it.
Exactly.
Now, we've gotten by because we're extremely primitive. But as we move into a highly technological and sophisticated kind of technology that allows us to do some of the things that are on the drawing boards right now, we have to make damn sure that our technology is correct, or we're going to make a lot of very, very serious mistakes in the future.
That's the whole thing right there.
Yes.
Does that make any sense to you?
It really does. And can I have a parting shot?
Sure.
I think that the danger is the roadblock that keeping us to making those strides to and progress of technology is specialization. I don't know if that's the only thing that's keeping us from making that progress. It could be stubborn minds too, but that I think the two go hand in hand. People are so one-track minded in their area of expertise. Yeah, they don't see across the boundaries that, of interrelationships between disciplines, and that would make these people less likely to open their minds. And
well, specialization is a very good point, because there was a time that was good, but now all things, as you even mentioned there, Hal, interrelate to the others in such an incredible way that specialization is probably passé.
Well, thank you for both your comments.
Larry wanted to say one thing, and then we're going to go.
Yes.
Yes. Now, take the what is called the atomic bomb blast, when they're testing, when they've been testing atomic bombs off and on for the last 20 or 25 years. You see, I believe that when you set off one of these blasts, any kind of a nuclear blast, you're affecting this space-time continuum or etheric energy envelope that surrounds the Earth with this tremendous blast going upwards, and it's going to, therefore, if what I'm saying is correct, it's going to cause a downward pressure of some enormous degree that will not necessarily go back to the same exact point on the Earth, but will affect, let's say, the atmosphere and the possibly the Van Allen radiation belts and the ozone layer and various things surrounding the Earth in ways that we haven't the slightest notion about, in adverse ways, because we're creating this, call it a negative force moving outwards, a blasting force that is totally unnatural and unplanned and unwanted by nature. And nature is going to react in some way violently against us when we play these crazy tricks on nature.
Okay, Hal?
Yes, I hope you're wrong, but I have a gut-level feeling you're right.
All right. That's what we're all about here, is to give you something to chew upon.
Okay.
All right, Hal. Thank you very much for listening and chewing just a bit. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Dr. Lawrence Boron. He's telling me I'm coming from left field at him here tonight. Come on, Larry. I'm not either. We just sit here and want to talk about the upside-down world.
Yeah, you're getting into it, all right.
All right. Alan, I think, wants to talk to us. Alan, welcome aboard. What's on your mind
tonight?
How
are you doing today?
Well, we're sitting here cooking.
Well, I wish I could say that. I'm freezing. That's one of my questions. I was wondering if you had any insight as this changing weather. I noticed in Southern California in the last 10 years from sort of a steady climate of you could count on heat during the summer and a rather cool in the winter, but no one knows how to dress anymore. You get up and it's freezing, and an hour later it's about 20 degrees warmer.
You missed the show last week, didn't you?
I guess I did, yes.
Yeah, Lowell Ponte was with me. Lowell wrote a book called The Cooling. And back in 1976, he was telling you to get heavier wear for Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it turned out that Lowell was absolutely, as he always is, exactly right.
But is there any scientific notion on what's causing this this apparent weather change in this area?
There is something called the El Nino effect that has been noticed by and commented on by scientists about a year to 2 years ago. It started where they began noticing that certain, let's say, motions of wind currents in the upper atmosphere were reversing themselves from their usual pattern, which they have observed once in a while to some small degree before, but I think this was greater than ever before, beginning about a year and a half ago. And apparently it's responsible for greater extremes in both heat in summer and cold in winter. It's reversed.
Is this peculiar to Southern California?
No. It's, for example, haven't you read that in Europe in the last two or three months they've had the warmest winter, I believe, for a long, long time, while we were going through the coldest winter of 70 years or so? They were going through one of the warmest winters maybe in 70 years. So something is screwing things up, obviously, in the weather patterns.
Well, what Lowell will tell you is that for the last 15 or 20 years, which is a geological twinkling, the Earth has been under what is known as a tremendous heat wave, which is terribly abnormal for the Earth. And that heat wave is now receding, and we're going back down. We're seeing a cooling of the Arctic mass, in fact, 1 or 2 degrees. That's offset a little bit by the man-made greenhouse effect that we see going on right now. Mm-hmm. However, the greenhouse effect probably is being overblown, according to Lowell, a little bit, simply because we are now cycling down from this enormous heat wave that we have had. Now, on a global scale, you could look at of us having to go through here in Southern California a month or two of 100 and better degrees during the summertime. Well, that's what the whole planet has been going down. And according to Lowell, we're getting back down to where we should be. and the skirt begins to move further and further southward, the skirt being where the warm air from the equator hits the cold air from the Arctic. That's where that comes together, is known as the skirt, and it sort of undulates all the way across the top of the planet or the bottom of the planet if you're in the southern hemisphere from the from the Arctic side.
Yeah.
And that certainly radically affects weather and where the rains will fall and that sort of thing. If you look back at weather records that go back 50, 60, 70 years ago, you'll see that this weather is not abnormal at all. We have just been in an abnormal period.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the last year and a half or so, we have been feeling the effects of the great volcanic eruptions at Mount St. Helens and the one down in Mexico, which for parts of the North American continent reduced the amount of energy that came from the sun. It was just blocked off 10-15% in some places, and so that naturally brought on even more cooling weather because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this shift in pattern affects one if they don't have a for instance, I'm losing sleep, I noticed, and that I'm trying to put my finger on this. I haven't had, you know, 4 hours sleep in the last 5 days, and I was wondering, I have noticed a cold and warm weather change, and I wanted to know if...
Do you live near the coast, by the way?
No, I live, maybe half an hour from it.
Up in the hills or mountains?
No, in the valley.
In the valley.
In the San Fernando Valley?
Yes.
That's a little unusual. A lot of people along the coast are having problems with sleeping. They're having behavior problems, and at the same time, if they've got certain kind of electronic devices that open and close their garage doors, they're not opening and closing because of a pulsing electromagnetic signal that's coming out from the Pacific Ocean. There's a Russian trawler out there. But we can't say that that's the cause of it, but they're having some enormous problems with electromagnetic devices, particularly in San Diego and up north into the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
And folks that are living along the coast, if they're experiencing erratic behavior, that probably is where it's coming from.
Yeah, well, this is really helpful. Getting back to my original point, do you think it'll ever revert back the weather in this area to a time, say, before 1976, when you can count on certain seasonal weather?
Well, according to Lowell Ponte, we're coming out of a heat wave. So, no, I don't think you'll see that for a while.
So we can just more or less count on most of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Alan. Thank you very much. Don, you're on.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Two quick comments and a question for Dr. Boren.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think that Chuck Waltman would make a very fascinating guest if he were willing to come on your program.
We're going to try to get Chuck on.
Okay. I was in a very select group in early January that had his theories presented. It was about 14 people assembled. And unfortunately, I'm an attorney by trade, and I can't say that I understood it all, but he's a very rational, sane man.
I had a chance to talk to him, and I found him to be, extremely interesting. I make no pretense about the fact that I am non-scientific, mm-hmm. but it was making sense to me.
Well, he made a lot of sense to me, and actually showed a presentation of some of the diagrams that he had, the actual models he had that he presented in the article on Newton's birthday, which happens to be Christmas Day.
Yeah, right.
And secondly, I appreciate your show, Bill. I think it's fantastic. I'd love to see your hours extended.
So would I. We're working on that.
Okay.
Maybe it will be.
That sounds like good news. A question for Dr. Bourne. I was curious, with his knowledge of gravity, if he saw any way to harness the force and use it for an effective, fast, and inexpensive transportation mode.
Yeah, well, you may be possibly referring to something called the anti-gravity device.
That's correct.
I believe that this new understanding would be very helpful there, although I believe also that the anti-gravity approach is based, as I understand it, more on the magnetic principle, actually using magnetic repulsion, which reverses the gravity force. If you harness the magnetic repulsion force properly. Now, there are some scientists working on this approach, and I believe they are using magnetic repulsion there. So it's just, you know, a little bit different force than the gravity force, but it creates something which we could call an anti-gravity reaction or effect. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, it's a counteracting force.
Yeah, counteracting force, right, that sets aside the law of gravity, as they say.
Exactly. I was just curious if you have any inside knowledge or work with any scientists that are working on that area.
I'm not presently working with any that are working on that. I just occasionally hear of some that are working in that area. But, of course, most of their work is highly secret, you know, until they get what they are after, you know, because we're living in times when anything can be stolen. It's very valuable and very significant, so everyone has to be very cautious about what they're working on.
Of course, I'm curious if in your own mind that it sounds like you do believe in UFOs, obviously, that if you believe that they've harnessed that particular force.
Well, I'll give you a little insight on that. We've had some sounds of UFOs here. There's no doubt in my mind that we had sounds from something that was not manufactured by the people that were giving us the sounds.
It's no propulsion that we know.
And what we were hearing and analyzing the sound of that were two spinning wheels of some kind going in opposite directions of each other at about 30,000 RPM. Now, those were developing an electromagnetic core, force of energy, which it sounded like they were doing. There is, within that whole kind of energy spectrum, two things turning in opposite directions.
Ah.
You're developing now a very strange movement of electrons and magnetic lines of forces whenever you do that, particularly at that high speed and with that energy.
I have a comment on that. This will be my prediction. I'll predict that...